Hello, I'm Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, and I'm inviting you to join me on season 3 of my podcast, Duchess. In the show, we explore the most historic homes of the UK and Ireland and meet the inspiring women who lead them. This is Duchess. Nestling in a coastal county between the stunning shore and heath of historic Norfolk is a stately home known for innovation, both agricultural and architectural, Raynham Hall. With its proud red brick facade, neoclassical influences of design permeate the whole structure. August, iconic columns, beautiful Venetian windows, and elegant Dutch gables. Raynham is the absolute vision of a grand home. When you approach the home, proceeding up the oak-laden driveway, you get a sense of synergy between place and home. Raynham belongs here. No surprise, then, that the family that owns Raynham is a mainstay of the surrounding landscape. The Townsends have lived in Norfolk countryside since the 12th century, a family whose impact can be felt on a global scale. Cities owe their namesake to Townsends. Monarchs have visited their homes, and even the agricultural revolution itself can be traced back to Raynham Hall. This is where, of course, you'll find Lady Townsend, a journalist and now a current custodian of Raynham, a mantle she shares with her husband George Townsend, the 8th Marquess Townsend. In today's episode, Lady Townsend walks us through the revolutionary design of Raynham Hall. We learn how Lord Turnip Townsend ushered in a new agricultural revolution, and Lady Townsend regales us with the story behind the world's most iconic ghost photograph, the Brown Lady.
I don't think we've been to Norfolk on our Duchess podcast before. And today I have the wonderful Lady Townsend, who lives at Raynham Hall. You haven't always been a lady. Tell us about your background and your roots.
Well, one of the reasons I love being at Raynham, or in Norfolk, shall we say, is to be able to find some roots, because as a Diplo brat, my father's a diplomat, we lived all over the world. And although I was born in London, at the age of 18 months, we went to Paris, where my father was first secretary. And so my first language actually was French. And then we went to Rio, where I learned to speak English. And finally, I learned to read English when we went to Peking, as it was there, nowadays Beijing. So I felt quite rooted in West Sussex, where I went to school, but not really. It was always somewhere hazily abroad, and my lovely suitcase in the laundry room at school waiting to take me to wherever they were. So when I came back to England, worked in London for a while and lived in West London and Chiswick. When I divorced, I lived up in the borders of Lincolnshire and Nottinghamshire in a darling little house. I think I wept for 3 weeks when I sold that. It was lovely. And then married Charles and came to Norfolk, where I feel part of Norfolk. I've only been here 30 years, so I'm still a new Norfolk person. If I can say I feel rooted and belong to Norfolk, that's true.
Oh, how wonderful. So the Townsends have had so many impactful and important figures in the family line. Can you give a history of some of the notable figures in your family, if you may, and how they came to be at Raynham Hall?
Yes, there was a man called Sir Roger Townsend, and he was knighted at the Siege of Cadiz, a very brave man, also frightfully handsome. He faced the Armada, and he married a remarkable woman called Jane Stanhope. Between them, they produced a rather disagreeable son, who was also a very good soldier, but a bit of a spendthrift. Sir Roger had been one of the richest men in East Anglia, and when he died, his mother, Jane, safeguarded the family fortunes, and from that, the next Sir Roger we hear about is the one who built this house. And he had a property already further downhill, looking up at the hill, and conceived this great house he wanted to build. And he selected a remarkably good and wise master mason called William Edge. And together they put this house here. After consulting many books, he had quite a library, Roger. And they went to the Low Countries and our distinctive Dutch gables. And also, actually, most distinctly, when you go to Holland, the thing you notice is that the walls are windows. And we have huge windows here. I mean, the house is as he built it almost, apart from one or two modifications and a William Kent restoration in the middle. But the outside of the house he would recognize. And you do notice the glass. You know, the walls are give way to the windows, which is so lovely. And it is in line very much with a philosophy in the early 17th century and late 16th to let in as much of the outside, the park, into the house as possible. So you were one with what went out outside. And light is enormously important. And that's the legacy. Actually, it's rather sort of trendy now. You know, it's come round again after 400 years.
And I believe the city of Sydney, Australia, has a connection with one of your namesake.
Yes, that's rather a lovely story. I should refer back really to the second Viscount, known as Turnip, Charles Townsend, who was the grandson of the man who built this house. And his second son had a son called Thomas Townsend. This grandson, Thomas, went into politics. He had made a good friend of somebody called Captain Phillips while he was involved with the Navy. When convicts were sent abroad to penal settlements, the family was torn apart. The father, son, husband was sent off for life somewhere else. The mother was sent to a workhouse. The children were sent God knows where, up chimneys probably. And he felt it was barbaric and also extremely uneconomic, because he felt that a man parted from his family was going to go into a Great Depression. He'd get drunk, he'd get violent. He had nothing to live for. And so he founded with Captain Phillips a colony. Originally, it was scheduled to be in Botany Bay, but it wasn't the right territory. And they founded a penal settlement in New South Wales. And when it became a town, this settlement, which was productive for everybody, they were allowed to keep part of the produce they farmed. Some of it had to go to the settlement, and it became known as a town. And they wanted it. They wanted it called Sydney, because Thomas Townsend by that stage had been elevated to the peerage as Lord Sydney.
How wonderful. And you touched on there, Alison, the relation of yours, Turnip. Because he was very instrumental, and I was just thinking about this the other day with all these enormous discussions about our beautiful green and rolling countryside throughout the British Isles. Now, your ancestor was spearheading the agricultural decisions made in the 1800s when we had our last agricultural revolution. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes.
Can you tell a little bit about the life and impact of Lord Turnip Townsend?
Well, I suppose one of the most telling things is that in the archive, there are many, many, I mean, boxes of letters from Charles Townsend to his factor, Mr. Ward, who was looking after the estate when he was away. He wrote passionately every week. And he would say things like, and how is the that new crop you put in by Mr. Clark's cottage, you know, and how is the drainage going on such and such a field? He was absolutely directly in contact with everything going on in his estate. So it is no surprise, really, that he was alive and awake to the possibilities of improving land and improving the yield from his land, because that was key, obviously, to keeping the house and the family and everything else going. And his time in Holland revealed to him that turnips were a very productive crop and would work in Norfolk, similar type of land, and that sheep, of which the estate had many, many, would be a prime asset, as would the turnips that they loved to eat. And so he introduced turnips into an annual crop. And the annual crop of turnips slotted into a rotation of, and this was his idea, also gathered from the Low Countries, not verbatim, but he worked out that barley, clover, wheat, and turnips would each have an effect on the soil, which contributed to the richness of the land. And my husband told me, I mean, Charles knows more about the agriculture than I do, but that this was the only grade one land in the county. And it was abused terribly in the days when chemicals ruled. But now it's coming back to its fruitful state, and yields are up, and it's very exciting to see old methods working. And I saw the other day, I went out for a walk, the sheep have finished eating off the tops of the turnips. So turnips are back, which was lovely.
Well, they are back at Beaver as well, let me tell you. I'm a big enormous fan of turnips in the winter months. They don't only finish our sheep off, brilliantly, but they're also great fodder for our partridges and pheasants, and they're great sort of coverage. So when we lose our maize, the turnips really help hold the birds in our shooting season. So
you don't use them as fodder for your guests. I'm afraid I make my guests eat them, those delicious little purple top ones in the spring. I say if they come to
Raynham,
they've got to have steamed and buttered turnips.
Oh, how lovely. Historically, Raynham was considered to be one of the most outstanding country houses of the period. Could you tell us about some of the fabulous, unique architecture at Raynham Hall?
Yes, there's one, I can't describe it as fabulous, there's one very interesting feature. His fellow Norfolk gentleman architect was Sir Roger Pratt, who built and designed Coles Hill. I mean, he was a very remarkable gentleman architect. And he came to the house just after Roger had died, and he said there was something in the proportions of height, breadth, and width that were divine and harmonious to the rational soul. I mean, he got the atmosphere immediately. But that's on a sort of rather more ethereal level. On a more mundane level, what we have discovered is that in 1620, looking at the bills, the builders were instructed to leave cavities in the walls for the lead pipes. So there was plumbing. And there was a great tank above the marble hall, great lead tank. And the water was pumped up there from a well in the courtyard. And two men would have simply pumped the water up like one of those two-handed saws, you know, pumped up and down. The water would go up to the tank in the top and then descend to the first floor. There would have been taps on every floor. Obviously not hot and cold, but cold water would have been available, pumped out. So that's, if you like, an engineering revelation. I mean, extraordinary in that time, because he was building his house on a hill. He lived in a house which was built by the water, because you need water for in and out, basically, for sanitation and also to provide your usual services. He'd observed that there was good water on the hill from the springs. I think it might have been a few damp years, because last year we saw lakes appearing on top of the hill. We are on top of a hill. But I suppose when he originally designed, there were two buildings. He designed originally an enormous house, as we've been told by the archaeologists locally, bigger than the footprint of Buckingham Palace. It had a huge courtyard in the middle, like Buckingham Palace. But it fell down because I surmise, having come across one myself, that he came across sand holes. The Norfolk and Norwich Hospital is built on piles because of sand holes. So there was a two-year gap during which we think he did research for this second house. And the second house was a block house, which at that stage was quite revolutionary. And it's in a single block with no courtyards. And it's centered on three large rooms, the marble hall, the saloon, which was a chapel, and above a very large double height dining room. So it was quite a bold move what he did, unlike any house that had been built so far. And Roger Pratt felt that this was a house 90 years ahead of its time. I think the windows are also quite remarkable. Huge amount of glass, very thin glass. We had 54 panes broken in a wind a few years ago, but wonderfully reflective. And there's a lovely effect in the winter, particularly when the sun is setting. If you stand at the bottom of the hill near the lake, it looks as if the house is on fire because of the light reflected in all this wonderful 18th century glass. So I'm not enough of an architect myself to be able to tell you what was revolutionary, but those are the points that actually strike me.
There have been a few very instrumental women in your lineage, I believe, haven't there? That just mention a few of them off the cuff, if you would, Alison.
The first wife I know about, Lady Jane Stanhope, who married the first Sir Roger, the Armada Roger. She was instrumental because without her, this house would not be here, without any doubt. And then Audrey Townsend. Audrey was an heiress who had a fantastic estate near Hartford called Balls Park. And she married the second Viscount. And he very much enjoyed her great wealth. I think they were still quite wealthy at that point, the Townsends, but it was no bad thing to have another house and a big estate come too. They parted company shortly after producing five children. She went to live in London, was a very, very respected correspondent of Horace Walpole, very clever woman. It was considered a belle of the fast. I think it's probably because she didn't have to have an escort to go to a party. She went by herself. But when the most important thing she did, really, if I can put it so brutally, is that she left her property of Balls Park to her grandson. Her grandson was called Jack, and he was a bit of a Jack the Lad. And through that, the Townsends still have Raynham. And if I can explain why, it's just that in the late 19th century, huge pressure was on estates like ours. Money, lack of funds, debts. And so we were able not to sell the house and the land because we had another house to sell. And there were a lot of pictures sold, 169 pictures, masses of silver, including, sadly, the George I Marquess's christening cup. But Balls Park saved this house. And I'm quite pleased they chose this house to keep rather than Balls, because it would be right almost in the middle of Hartford now. So we have acres of lovely North Norfolk countryside around us, and it's not as full of some fabulous pictures that there were, but we still have a lot of very interesting family portraits.
One of the things that, if you've listened to the podcast, I hope it's not annoying our listeners, but it is the truth that we have these things that can go bang in the night. And do you have any of those stories at Raynham?
Well, we have one of the most famous ghosts in England, the Brown Lady, who is supposed to be second wife of the second Viscount, Dorothy Walpole, who is the younger sister of Robert Walpole, who was a political colleague of Charles Townsend's, otherwise known as Turnip. And she was seen haunting the house. She had a reputation for haunting the house. And I think last time she was seen by not exactly a member of the family, but a friend so close he could be, was in the 50s. And then there was a trunk of bills found in the archive detailing years, or certainly months, of medical treatment for Dolly Walpole. And then she apparently died of smallpox. Now, I know that smallpox doesn't take months. It's pretty quick. And my theory, including the rumours that have abounded about Dolly Walpole, is that she had a form of early onset dementia. She was apparently held prisoner in her room. She was found wandering. When she escaped, she would escape on tradesmen's carts and things. And I think that the second Viscount was utterly distraught by it and sought as much medical help as he probably could from far-flung places, you know, Bristol, Paris, London, to see what was wrong with her. Because also the other thing was that you would have to keep it pretty quiet, because as you can imagine, it would have been regarded as madness, not a sort of perfectly normal affliction. And if it was madness in the family, that was frankly the end of the family line. I think she was treated terribly well, and I think when her bills were found, she stopped haunting the house. There's no feeling of her here at all. And there is a very famous picture taken of her, which was in Country Life, descending the stairs. And I fully believe that the family did feel her or saw her, and I think she's now doesn't have to say anything. And she said, well, thank goodness you found all the evidence that I was so loved, I'm now going to retire.
Aww.
There's no bad feeling in this house. It's quite extraordinary. It's the most emotionally calm and welcoming house I think I have ever lived in. I can walk around this house in the pitch black without a single goosebump.
That's something else. That's not something I can do here, I can tell you.
It seems to me that Lady Townsend is an absolute mirror of her wonderful home. She exudes a sense of ease while also displaying so much insight and passion for heritage. I'm so interested to learn more about her and Raynham Hall. Since we began Duchess the podcast, so many of you have reached out expressing the wish to make listening to Duchess a reality. We adore making this podcast, but we know nothing compares to experiencing these beautiful places for yourself. So, for people who want a once-in-a-lifetime experience, we've partnered with the award-winning luxury travel company Abercrombie & Kent to bring our much-loved podcast to life. From guided tours, stays in grand rooms, fishing trips on the family lake, to private tours of beautiful gardens, our partnership with Abercrombie & Kent will enable you to experience Duchess, the podcast, for yourself from Inverary to Beaver and beyond. With Abercrombie & Kent, you can come and stay, visit and explore the houses that are featured in our series Duchess. Our partnership with Abercrombie and Kent will enable you to experience Duchess the podcast for yourself with your own tailor-made itinerary. For more information, visit abercrombiekent.co.uk/duchess. We'll put a link in the show notes. This is just a quick reminder that you're listening to Duchess, hosted by me, Emma Rutland, and this is a podcast produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. Coming up in the podcast, Lady Townsend explains why music is part of the DNA of stately homes, and I'm introduced to the tragic, haunting portraits that Lady Townsend treasures so dearly. But first, I wanted to know more about how did Lady Townsend understand and interpret her role on the estate?
So how would you describe today, Alison, your role marrying into a family and home such as you have?
Well, as you know, it's primarily about doing everything one does in a home normally, but just magnified. You work out what needs to be treasured, what needs to be mended, what needs to be put away safely, oil on troubled waters with staff having disagreements, and then you cast your eye over the gardens as well. It is all-encompassing, really. Charles tends to do things like, you know, the roof, the walls, and all that stuff. It's everything which makes a home, which I look after. And also, my concept was the recitals we have here, so I'm quite busy doing that. And we also have open days. They have a tour of the whole house, 17 rooms, and that includes, occasionally, my bedroom. Depends on how nice they are.
Oh, how lovely. Well, is that lovely? I don't know. It must be seem very strange to some of our listeners when they imagine letting whoever into one's bedroom, not at the hours of dusk.
Clearly, it's got to be pretty tidy. But the reason why I do let them in occasionally, it's usually private tours, is that it's the room in which Charles II slept when he visited Raynham. And he visited Raynham as a thank you, I suppose, to Horatio, who had been instrumental in the campaign to have the monarchy restored.
Just to explain to our listeners, Alison, some of the things that you get involved in and do at Raynham.
2 winters ago, viewing the appalling, frilly, inappropriate canopies on the four-poster beds, I decided that I would reupholster them. And since at Raynham we're poor on pennies, rich in, if you like, assets of furniture and things, I thought that I would find some crewel work embroidery and just fashion some pelmets myself. And so a bit of an adventure with finally it coming from Srinagar, about, I would say, less than an eighth of the price you can buy it in England. I unrolled this beautiful crewel work, only to find it was dirty out the middle. And so with long discussion about replacing it, and eventually, having made my pattern, I set about doing the four-poster beds. And that's quite an exercise because no two sides are the same. And I had no idea how to do it. I just had to sort of work it out. But I did 2 in the end, and I'm now doing a third. So that's one sort of thing you just tackle, not knowing what you're doing, but knowing there is no other way to do it. So single-mindedly, as you rightly say, you think, I can do this. I know I can do this. It's just a matter of logic. Oh, that was the wrong order to do things. Never mind, I'll do it and get better next time. But that's certainly one project.
But there are other things that you put your past to, all the things that you learned as a young woman, you have brought with you.
My knowledge of music has helped enormously because I suppose when I first came into the house with Charles, there was this amazing space and it just made me want to sing. It practically draws it out of you. There's an amazing resonance there. And I just felt that when we came to Raynham, we had to have music there. But we knew that if we were going to have people to Raynham, we had to do something very different. And we were advised by a friend who is, I think, probably the best countertenor the world has had, called Michael Chance. And he teaches in the Hague and the Royal College and Royal Academy. And he said, if you have music here, you have just got to have the best. And I said, can I make it short? I only wanted an hour because I think everybody's attention span's gone after an hour. And he said, yes, an hour, but the best. And it's going to cost you a lot of money. And so that's what we've done. And it has a pretty regular core audience. Obviously, I wish we were always full every time. And it is seat of the pants stuff because it's me that pays if the tickets don't cover the musicians. But each one is absolutely astounding. And people sometimes leave unable to speak. They've been so touched by this incredible music performed by people. We only have musicians who know how to give. I mean, they just engage with the audience so deeply. They're move between tears and laughter. It's absolutely wonderful. You know, it's like having a soiree or a salon in a private house, which it is. But I'm sad they have to pay. But that's, you know, when I'm in the lottery, I might give a free concert.
Oh, that's so nice.
I do the lottery. I hope you do too.
No, I'm not a lottery girl, no, but I'm very pleased to hear that you are. What sort of music and where do the musicians come from?
They are international musicians, and the music we have here does not involve a piano because the resonance is too much for a grand piano. To hear Dowland in the Marble Hall is to go to heaven. It's simply beautiful. And we've had Emma Kirkby here. We had an amazing concert in November with Julia Doyle, the baroque soprano. And she said, after singing there, she said, I just didn't have to sing. It just came out. It was just the most extraordinary place to perform. So that was wonderful. Mm-hmm. We've had a wonderful mandolin player, Avi Avital, drop-dead gorgeous. We've had the superb harpsichord player, Mahanis Vahani. He's Persian, brought up in America. Absolute maestro on the harpsichord, charming, and he's played Gilberg variations, and he's coming again at some point.
And if I came along to one of these recitals, how much would I pay for my ticket?
£50. Which in London doesn't sound much, but in the country it sounds a lot.
And if any of our listeners were staying in Burnham Market, how far are you from Burnham Market?
About 20 minutes. And they would just need to look at the website. All the details are on the website. We also have a lovely thing, which was Michael Charles's suggestion, and that is, it's a form of opera performed by, originally it was the Royal Academy of Music, and now it's the Royal College of Music. And these are final year students. At the moment, their voices are at their peak, I have to say, coming and performing under his direction. An opera or part of an opera, which is always absolutely jam-packed full. The audience love that one.
Beautiful. And I always feel it's one of those great gifts that we're given, isn't it? Living in heritage and being able to use it to help young people.
Yes.
Because so much of the buildings that we live in, as you say, asks for music. And it just goes back to its roots, because traditionally these houses would have had recitals for every group of people that they had visiting. So it just really is very integral in the DNA in our properties, I feel.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it was hugely important. I mean, what else did they do? They all played music. That was the thing. They all knew how to play music. When you were at Cambridge for a degree, in your degree was music. Astronomy and music, as well as mathematics. It's only recently that we've disregarded it.
We also had music in the Welsh Borders, where I grew up. And being from a Quaker background, they all would sing round the piano. My grandfather was one of seven. And everyone had a certain voice, and they all sang in harmony. Which reminds me of a wonderful weekend we had this weekend with all my daughter Eliza's friends came to stay. And one always suddenly needs someone to be able to sing, play a piano, recite a poem when you're sitting in a place like Beaver having dinner. And it's always surprising how few of us, and I have to say I've forgotten all my poetry and my voice went a long time ago, but how few young people have that confidence and ability to just wing it and have a go. That's all one wants, really.
Oh, what a lovely memory. I mean, I can just imagine the piano and the voices.
Those are the sort of things that take hold and then they become the tradition, a new tradition. And that's the other great thing about us girls, is that we bring our passions and our loves to these homes, and then somehow they become part of the fabric of the building, don't they? Part of the DNA.
Yes.
That we leave behind.
Yes.
Now, is that a piano behind you?
Oh, no, that's my harpsichord. I'm going to move slightly so you can see it. It is simply beautiful. Made by a lovely Norwich man. When both parents had died and there was a small sum of money to be spent or saved or put in the black hole, I decided that I would buy something quite remarkable. And I had noticed the harpsichords of Alan Gotto. I thought he was dead, actually. I kept seeing his harpsichords being used for recordings on television or concerts. And it said Gotto Norwich. And I thought, what a marvellous name to have had for a harpsichord maker. And one day I went up after the concert to look at the harpsichord, and it has an attraction to me because it's plucked rather than hammered. You know, it's got this lovely sort of different distinctive tone. And I'm obviously muttered to myself, oh, another Gotto, at which point the man sitting next to it said, yes, that's me. And I nearly fell off the stage. And through that, I realized when I was going to buy one, who would make it for me.
Oh, how amazing. What a fabulous story. It looks divine. And you actually play it?
Very, very badly, in total private, with both doors closed.
Oh, the one thing for absolute certain, Alice, is that nothing ever truly, other than that harpsichord, belongs to us, does it? It's something we're a custodian of.
I know, it's quite true. It's funny, because when I came in the house, there were various bits of furniture, and I wonder if you found this too. They were very unhappy where they were. It was almost as if there was a little hand going out saying, please, can you move me? I've been here for 50 years, and I'm really not very happy in this room. And you just move furniture around, and suddenly the house sort of just gives a big sigh and says, yes, that's better. And so that's been fun doing that. But I think the thing that I will miss most about leaving Raynham would be two portraits, which I can't say I discovered, but they were rather forlornly marooned on a wall in a bedroom upstairs. Two little girls looking like death. And they are, in fact, portraits of the daughters of Charles I, Princess Henrietta and her elder sister, Princess Elizabeth. And our local conservation expert, Kirsten Hutchins, came and saw. And she said, these are remarkable portraits. And I think they're by Cornelius Johnson, so undiscovered. And we have been raising funds to restore the portraits, and we're just beginning on Princess Elizabeth, the older one. But, you know, diving into their stories was harrowing, I have to say. The Henrietta married the rather brutal younger brother of Louis XIV, and she died early. There were theories that she was poisoned. Who knows? It wasn't a happy marriage. But she was very instrumental in communicating with her brother about the court of Louis XIV, and he relied on her enormously, as Charles II. I mean, they're haunting, haunting pictures. I'm sort of looking sideways at them now. And the elder girl, she was the person, the child whom Charles I confided and left trust in the night before he was executed. And she took with her her youngest brother, Duke of Gloucester, who sat on the king's knee. And she wrote her memoirs, and in it he says to her, "You must remember everything I tell you, because, you know, you must not let them put crowns on your brother's heads because they will cut them off." And can you imagine, as a child of 14, just remembering this, knowing you're not going to see your father again, and seeing your little brother convulsed in tears? And it must have been harrowing. He also absolutely emphasized that she must always belong to the Church of England, and that was very, very key. She left him, and on the journey to Carisbrook Castle, where she was to be imprisoned again, she'd been in prison since the age of 7. She caught a cold, and she died in Carisbrook Castle of pneumonia, aged barely 15. Wow. These are now treasured, these portraits, because they are very, very fine. And they're so gripping. And they were given to Horatio by Charles II, his two little sisters. So, you know, those are something so close to my heart that, you know, if the house were to catch fire, I'd make sure the dogs were safe and I'd go and take these pictures with me, one under each arm. I mean, I'm in tears now because they are, it is the most touching story. Oh. They are very, very precious.
Oh.
They're not Townsends. They're just, they were given to the Townsends. And they are only oil paintings of these girls in existence. And I feel that we are very, very lucky to be the custodians of these girls.
Oh, what an amazing story. And how touching that it still to this day has this effect on you.
It does.
Because
it
I'm
does.
Very lucky
yes.
to be in your graceful hands. So well done. Could you tell us about the first time you saw Rainham Hall, Alison?
Yes, we approach from the lake drive at the bottom, and I saw this lovely rosy red and stone building with a great deal of sky behind it. And it was literally when I married Charles, or just before I married him. I had never been to Norfolk. It looked so seated. It's at the end of an avenue of lime trees, very ancient lime trees, but they're big, generous, leafy branches spreading over the grass. And at the top of this hill was this very beautifully coloured house with the sun on the brick. And it just looked very warm and welcoming, not at all daunting. It's a house, it's a home. We really very much feel, everybody who comes here at the end of a tour says, she said, I thought, it is big, she said, but it feels just like a home. And it is very much a home, this house. We reluctantly describe ourselves as a stately home because we live in all of it. And it has a domestic feel to it. There are lots of surprises in the house, but they're all very gentle surprises. There's nothing made to make people cower. It's a very, very welcoming, gentle house.
I think we feel that just by hearing your wonderful voice. And our last question today, what would you say to six generations in the past if they were sitting with you in your beautiful drawing room? What would you say to them?
I'm looking after it. That's what I would say. And I love it.
Oh. And last but never least, what will you say to your offspring that are going to one day take the mantle of Rainham Hall forward, six generations down the line from you?
Exactly the same thing. Love it and look after it. Exactly the same. That's all you can do to a home. You can't dictate what they'll do. You can't dictate what finances will make you do or have to do. Love it and look after it.
Love it and look after it. And today from Norfolk, what an inspiring talk and what an amazing home that I myself will definitely be visiting one of your recitals this year, together with a host of other listeners, I'm quite sure. Lady Townsend, it's been a complete honour, and thank you for sharing with us so much of your knowledge.
You're very welcome, and it was lovely to talk to you, and particularly nice for me to be able to talk about Raynham. It's not often that the woman gets to do the talking. We do the loving of the house, but it's been marvellous to share my feelings about Raynham.
Thank you.
I have always said that life in heritage is a partnership with people, with community, with your surroundings. In many ways, a life of custodianship is a life defined by sharing your home, your history, your estate with others, and people sharing their time and their love and their support with you. What I loved about speaking with Lady Townsend today is the fact that we both share such a strong passion for heritage. Love and passion have been imbued in every turnip grown, every note sung, and every tour given here. I'm sure if the Brown Lady could hear us today, she would be overjoyed to know her home is in such reverent and assured hands. Thank you so much, Lady Townsend, for joining me on the podcast today. And thank you all at home for listening. Next week on the podcast, I will be speaking to Sarah Troughton of the remarkable Blair Castle. In the episode, I discover how Sarah's ancestors came to own the Isle of Man. I'm introduced to the first female minister of state who stood up to Hitler. And I learn about the Athol Highlanders, the last private army in Europe. We'll see you there. Now, my dear listeners, I've been asking you to write to me, and today we have another lovely message from Jess. Hi, Emma. My name is Jess, and I'm a 17-year-old student studying my A-levels. Some women that inspire me today would be a mix of Julie Andrews for her elegance and warmth in her voice, the Duchess of Cambridge for her style and big heart when it comes to children, and lastly, I'd say you. I've only just finished the episode of the enlightening conversation between you and Demetra Lindsay about Headingham Castle, but I know that I can't wait to listen to the next episode. I believe that your podcasts are truly hidden gems. Please don't stop doing them. Many thanks, Jess. Oh, Jess, I'm so, so touched by that message. And I'm deeply honoured that you've called me an inspiring person and linked me with Julie Andrews, who I totally adore, particularly in The Sound of Music, but with the Duchess of Cambridge, who I'm one of her greatest fans also. There are just a few quick notes before we go. Make sure to follow Duchess wherever you listen to podcasts. One of my favourite things about the podcast is learning more about you and hearing your stories. So please write to me. Tell me about your own lineage and share with me the women who've inspired you in your life. You can write to me at duchessthepodcast.com. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast presented by me, Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, and produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Lady Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Additional creative support from Selena Christofies and Theo Banner. Thanks for listening to Duchess, the podcast.